Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
There is no place for a national leader to prey on the fears of people.
I would hope that Mr. Trump tones it down big time and tells his supporters that violence is not acceptable.
We need a candidate who respects the people, who engages, even engages the protesters with civility and respect.
He talks about deporting 11, 12 million immigrants. We're a nation built on immigrants. He talks about preventing Muslims from coming into our country. We believe in religious freedom.
Some of these people are professional disruptors, okay? They get hired, they get paid to be rude and nasty. I'm not excusing that. But I'm also not excusing the fact that you have a leading contender for president telling people in his audience, go ahead and punch someone in the face, I'll pay your legal bills.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Taz Willick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Several incidents of protest and violence, or tension threatening to spill over into violence, have marred political rallies held by candidate Donald Trump, fueled in many cases by Trump's own incitement.
You go to one of these rallies and you protest, oh, you'll be in trouble. They'll lock you up for the rest of your life. They'll give you the electric chair and they'll say, poor Bernie, oh, poor Bernie, he had to endure this. With us, they don't say that.
The escalations in some ways, however, have been predictable. Grievance over class, the economy, race, and social status have charged the American political debate before, and often with similar results. And part of the question is, where does it go from here? With me now to provide some perspective on the turbulence surrounding Trump's campaign is Heather Cox Richardson, a historian at Boston College. Heather, welcome.
Good morning.
Your thoughts as you watched the violent episodes unfold in North Carolina and then in Chicago over the weekend?
Well, Americans like to think we don't do political violence, but in fact, it's pretty much the way we've always done business, even before the original Tea Party in 1773. So what we're seeing now is really nothing new.
You've argued that this, in the modern era, is following some predictable patterns so far.
It is. When Americans riot over politics and when they use the kind of language they do over politics, what they're really doing is making the argument that the government is responding to some special interest, that it's not doing what is best for everybody. And they want that inequality, they think, that lack of fairness fixed. So rioting when it happens, and as say it always has happened, is usually somebody trying to call attention to a perceived inequality in American government. And unfortunately, that's something that politicians like Donald Trump can use to whip people up to say, you need to take your country back. And Americans are very patriotic. We want to take our country back. We want it to be great. So it's a very easy way for a politician to whip up support. And you see it now with Donald Trump, but the other really clear parallel to that was in 1962 when the governor of Mississippi didn't want desegregation to hit the University of Mississippi, and we got the Ole Miss riots. Very similar language, very similar kind of mobs.
So do you put then the Trump phenomenon into that context of 1962 when you hear Donald Trump say specific things like, you know, in the old days, those protesters would have been treated very roughly, but we're all too politically correct now? What is he saying there?
Well, that's exactly what he's saying. But what he is arguing is the language that the Republican Party, the people who control it now, the movement conservatives, have been saying since at least the 1950s, and you could argue back into the 1930s, and that is that the government, by being activist, by having social welfare legislation, by regulating business, by getting involved in the economy and trying to level the playing field, is somehow privileging minorities, women, people who are the takers, not the makers. And that hits, according to this language, that hits the white, primarily, taxpayers who have to put up tax dollars for this. So, in fact, any kind of government activism to level the economic playing field, level the racial playing field, level the gender playing field, is somehow a redistribution of wealth from white, hardworking taxpayers to lazy people who just want a handout.
Right.
And if that's the case, that's the sort of thing that somebody looks at and says, this isn't fair. We want it fixed.
Right. But Heather Cox Richardson, you know, there have been hits on this kind of maker and taker politics recently before. There were hits in the 80s on welfare queens. We've seen kind of coded language around entitlements and race lots of times before. But Trump's rhetoric seems to be a new level. When he talks about political correctness, he isn't talking about language or entitlement. Sometimes he's talking about physicality. In the old days, those protesters would have been treated roughly, but political correctness prevents us from doing what we should do to them.
Well, what he's done is he's ripped the veneer off that genteel coded language, if you will. And he in a way, is not a politician. He's much more a salesman, sort of taking that rhetoric to the next step. The other thing he does very, very well as a speaker is he manages to use very short sentences, much like a salesman. He backloads those sentences so the final word in every sentence is an emotional word, loss, danger, terrorism, words that whip people up. And he doesn't actually try to appeal at all to reason. He's a salesman and he is appealing to emotion. And he's doing it very deliberately. He's a very good speaker. So that's very different than we've had before with Republican politicians who have used the coded language to get the votes, but they're really much more interested in an economic program. He's simply interested in having the crowds behind him. And this is a new phenomenon, except on the fringes of American politics. You know, Father Coughlin did that. Huey Long did that. But they were not people who were directing a major political party. And at this point, Trump is. It's a new moment in that way in American history.
What about the wellspring of some of this antipathy that Trump is responsible for himself? I want you to tell me if you think he is responsible for it. Many candidates have suggested that his own promotion of birtherism in 2011 and 2012 and getting a movement behind the idea that Barack Obama wasn't really American, and then Mitt Romney as the nominee coming to seek Donald Trump's endorsement really helped to signal to conservative voters that if they were xenophobic or if they had these feelings of antipathy, that there was a place for them.
Well, as I say, what makes Trump such an interesting character in the political moment is that he's a salesman and he is speaking the language that his followers want to hear. Rather than constructing that himself, I think he's hearing it, seeing it, and giving it an emotional impact on a national scale that no other person in the party would do. So he is not creating it, I don't think. He is voicing it. And then he's permitting it to go further by legitimizing it. That's, you know, what I keep saying. Somebody asked me the other day, who can stop this? The people who can stop this are the same people who could stop it when George Wallace did it back in the 60s. And that is the leaders of the party to step forward and reject this language the way that the Democrats did with Wallace. And so far, they're hedging, which I just find is astonishing.
So you don't,
to hedge so, on the KKK.
So you don't think there's a scenario where Trump de-escalates here? He loses support if he does so?
Well, it's interesting. I thought he would. I thought actually starting last week he was starting to de-escalate. I thought his performance in the last debate suggested he was backing off. And in fact, I think now in a way he has no choice because he has let these forces loose. He's going to have a very hard time right now backing off from them. And you saw that this weekend when he sort of tried to back off and then stepped forward and said, we need more of this. I don't think at this point he's going to be the one who can make it go away. It's going to have to be some of the other leaders in the party.
Heather Cox Richardson, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Heather Cox Richardson is a historian at Boston College.